This is Jen Psaki. Welcome to our first episode of DiploPod for 2018. Late last week, I sat down with Jeff Feltman, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs at the United Nations. He was the highest-level UN official to visit Pyongyang since 2011, back in December. We discussed his trip, what we should make of the New Year's speech by Kim Jong-un, and what role the United States should play moving forward. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us in our DiploPod studio for our first episode of 2018. In a New Year's address earlier this week, Kim Jong-un offered what sounded to many analysts like a surprising olive branch to the South Koreans. Is that an overly optimistic reading of his remarks?
I would describe what he said in terms of the inter-Korean relationship and the need to move toward de-escalation and reopening channels as something encouraging. I don't know how this will develop. None of us know how this will develop yet. But it certainly is something that I think that the Republic of Korea should and, of course, is exploring. You know, other parts of that address were very much consistent with the policies we know, the defiance of the international community in terms of development of the nuclear and rocket technology, things like that. There didn't seem to be any flexibility on his refusal to comply with the Security Council resolutions and with the international consensus about nuclear nonproliferation. But on that, I think it's very, very important for the exploration to continue. What did he mean? What's possible? Can you move toward de-escalation of tensions? Can you reduce the risk of an accidental war? At this point, of course, they've agreed to reopen civilian channels. That's still not the same as reopening military-to-military channels, but it is a start, and we'll see what comes out of the meeting that's now scheduled.
In the speech, and you mentioned this, there was a lot of consistent rhetoric in terms of referencing the United States and that we've heard before. Did Kim Jong-un's message, strong warning to the United States that the entire U.S. mainland is in range, is that more of the same? Is that increasing rhetoric an indication of greater intention, or do we just not know at this point?
I think we don't know, but it is consistent with what I understand is their policy, where they believe that because of the hostile U.S. policy, as they describe it, they have no choice but to develop an effective nuclear deterrence. You know, that is the policy that was explained to us when we were there. We, of course, pushed back and talked about the need to comply again with the Security Council sanctions and listen to the international community's concern. But those parts of his speech were very much consistent with what we understand is the policy of developing nuclear deterrence against what they describe as an unrelentingly hostile U.S. policy. There's a risk here, because what they see as deterrence could provoke the type of conflict, could cross red lines and provoke a reaction that they say that deterrence is supposed to be preventing.
And you recently, before the New Year's speech, of course, you were the first U.N. official to visit Pyongyang since 2011. My information is correct. What did you hope going into that trip? What did you hope to learn from that trip or come away from that trip understanding or knowing better?
I mean, first of all, there is a small UN presence in Pyongyang, and there have been UN officials that have gone back and forth. What was different about my visit was, first of all, the level. There hadn't been an undersecretary general level, which is sort of the rank just below the secretary general since 2011. And there hadn't been a political dialogue visit since 2010, almost 8 years. I have to say our expectations were modest. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be able to have the chance to explain to the officials we met why the international community is united in its concern about the nuclear proliferation on the Korean Peninsula, why the international community wants to see a de-escalation and a move toward negotiations. And we also wanted to give them a chance to be able to talk to us about the United Nations. We didn't have any expectations that all of a sudden a single trip to Pyongyang, we were there for 4.5 days, would change the entire calculations of the DPRK leadership. We didn't expect that. We wanted to start making sure that they understood how unified the international community is. It's not simply a problem with the United States. And how important it was to move toward reducing the risk of accidental war, reopening communication channels. to reduce the risk of an accidental war.
And when you were there, you said 4.5 days, you spent hours talking to officials there. What was most surprising to you, if anything, about your time talking with them?
I mean, perhaps this reveals my own ignorance about North Korean negotiating tactics, because I had never been to Pyongyang before, and while I had met with DPRK officials when they were in New York, I had never had the opportunity to have sustained dialogue over a course of several days. But one of the things, so perhaps it's just reveals my own naivete about their style. But I had expected a much more rigid reading of prepared policy positions, reading of polemical talking points. I hadn't expected the type of give and take, back and forth, interactive, and lengthy exchanges that we had. They regularly would schedule a meeting for an hour or something, and it would go for four. Mm-hmm. And they would allow us the time, the space to make our arguments, to explain our points, and they asked lots of questions about our points. They pushed back, they asked questions, but there seemed to be a desire on their part to truly understand why were we emphasizing what we were emphasizing, why were we so insistent on moving toward engagement rather than escalation. What did we think could be achieved through diplomacy, given the what they saw as a failed history since 1994 in various channels? So I was surprised at the openness that they gave us in making our points. They were not soft in terms of presenting their own position papers, their own positions. I don't want to suggest that they didn't reflect accurately the policies that they were supposed to be representing, but they did give us the time to push back against theirs.
And when you returned from your trip, you said you were, quote, really worried about an accidental move toward conflict and the lack of communication. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by that and what it means moving forward?
Well, look, they agree. The DPRK officials we met, the foreign minister, vice foreign minister, their delegations, they agreed with us that there's no more urgent, there's no hotter place on the planet in terms of peace and security right now than the Korean Peninsula. They agreed with us on the need to do whatever is possible to avoid war, at least in principle. But there's absolutely no trust between the various parties involved with the issues on the Korean Peninsula. No trust. And there was almost no communication. You have a situation in the West Sea where the DPRK does not accept the Northern Limitation Line that the Republic of Korea, the United States, and others define as the maritime border. You could have a navigation incident. You could have a fishing incident. You have no way of managing such an incident. You have no way of conveying intentions to make sure the other side doesn't misread your intentions. So we were very concerned about the fact that there could be an unintended conflict because of the lack of communications, the lack of being able to convey or check intentions, and the lack of trust. And so we were really pushing toward reopening some type of technical communications, as well as signaling a willingness to start moving toward engagement at a more strategic level.
And do you think, obviously there's long been a lot of heated rhetoric coming from North Korea. There's recently been a more increased level of heated rhetoric coming from the United States. Is that problematic in moving forward? Is that less of a factor than people anticipate here? What was your perception of that from being there?
I mean, we think it's a problem. Secretary General was clear about this in his own address, the UN Secretary General's own address to the General Assembly, his first address to the General Assembly back in September, where he talked about the fact that fiery rhetoric escalates tensions. And when you have escalation tensions, you can lead to fatal miscalculations, fatal misunderstandings. The UN Charter requires member states not only to refrain from the use of force except in specific circumstances, but also to refrain from the threat of force. And so we see the rhetoric as being a problem and not helpful as we look to move toward de-escalation, prevention of war, and steps toward resolving the nuclear issues.
And before you were in your senior position at the United Nations, you were a longtime diplomat in the United States. What is the role, what role could the United States be playing now that would be constructive and help move this process forward?
Well, I think that, I mean, first of all, the role of the United States is essential. Mm-hmm. You know, the UN itself is not part of the six-party talks. The six-party talks is still, even though it's not been active, it's still the agreed framework through by the Security Council, by multiple Security Council resolutions passed unanimously, the agreed framework for how you resolve this question over the long term. And the United States is key in that. Pyongyang clearly is focused primarily on Washington, the relationship with Washington, which again reinforces the importance of Washington in this whole process. And obviously, with the stated threats to the U.S. mainland, this is one of the top priorities, if not the top priority of Washington policymakers. I would assume. I'm not part of that circle anymore, but I would assume. I think it was very helpful that the Republic of Korea and the United States have agreed to postpone the spring military exercises. I'm not questioning the military exercises in general. That's a bilateral issue for the Republic of Korea and the United States to work out. But because they've agreed to postpone the talks until after the Winter Olympics and the Paralympics, it extends what we hope can be seen as a window of opportunity. A window of opportunity provided by the reopening of civilian talks across the DMZ, a opportunity provided by the positive atmosphere people were trying to create for the Winter Olympics, and it was reinforced by the General Assembly. Maybe this period can be used to start moving back toward some kind of diplomatic framework that can address some of the fundamental security and nuclear issues that the world has.
So you answered my next question proactively a bit there. But so it sounds like you think the diplomatic window, the window for diplomacy, is still open with the United States playing a role in that process.
Well, the United States itself endorses that. Not only has President Trump and the U.S. Korean Forces General welcomed the reopening of intra-Korean civilian technical contacts and talks, but also the U.S. has promoted, has been the penholder, which means the primary drafter, of the Security Council resolutions that have been passed repeatedly. The most recent resolution, 2397, like the previous resolutions, are not only about sanctions and pressure. Those resolutions also contain important parts about the need to de-escalate tensions and the need to move back toward diplomatic, peaceful, and political solutions to address the concerns. And so the United States is on record as supporting a diplomatic effort. Again, it's not the exclusive tool in the international community's toolbox. Sanctions are an important part of that. Sanctions demonstrate the unity of the international community. It's unacceptance of the nuclear program. But those same resolutions also show the international community's unanimous agreement that there needs to be a diplomatic, peaceful, political solution.
Before I let you go, I just wanted to ask, of the big global issues that come across your desk every day, and obviously you deal with far more than North Korea, many issues around the world, what is not receiving enough attention from the media, from the public, that should have more light shown on it?
I mean, first of all, I think that the fact that the media is paying attention to the Korean Peninsula is important because I don't think there is a more important peace and security issue in the world than the one that you and I have been discussing today. That the implications of a war would be catastrophic. In terms of things that aren't being paid sufficient attention to, they're longer-term trends. It's harder to report on these. I think that you see a retrenchment of democratic governance, of good governance around the world. I don't know how you report on that on a day-to-day basis, but it's of great concern to us. I believe that while it's gotten attention, there hasn't been sufficient reaction to the attention, which is the Yemen war. Mm-hmm. You know, the humanitarian consequences of the Yemen war maybe have not yet been as bad as the Syria war, but they're ongoing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Well, thank you for joining us in DiploPod and for such a thoughtful conversation.
Thank you very much for having me, Jen.
Episodes of Carnegie's DiploPod are available from Carnegie's website, carnegieendowment.org, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume podcasts. Follow us at Carnegie DiploPod. I'm Jen Psaki. Thanks for listening.